Welcome to the White House pub in Limerick. This is on the main street, O'Connell Street in Limerick, and I'm recording this audio boo specially for three people, and you're very welcome to listen in on it. But it's particularly designed to remind three people of the wonderful occasion that we met in this particular pub sometime earlier this year. The three people in question are AJ Leon, Melissa Leon, and Jesse M. White. And I'm standing exactly where I was standing where these three people opened the door and walked into this pub and changed my life. And they and I had a kind of a courtship from afar, in which we gradually weaved our way to meeting in this particular bar. So I've come into the bar specially to record this audio book for the Misfits. Guys, I've got a pint of Guinness in front of me, and I'm surrounded by things here, and I'm going to read you something from the wall of the White House pub that you won't have come across while you were here. And it's a headline, this particular headline, which appeared in the Limerick Chronicle news item in May of 1975, and it followed a visit to Limerick by Robert Graves. Now, Robert Graves died earlier in the year, 90 years of age, in May 1975, I think he died then. Anyway, the piece is called Pound Devalued in White House. Pound Devalued in White House. And it's written by John Liddy, and here it is specially for you. It was suggested to the proprietor that he remove a photograph of Ezra Pound before Robert Graves and his entourage of chosen literati entered Gleason's old world, White House, in the thrice sieged city of Limerick. This is in the form of a poem, by the way, and that's the first stanza. In the thrice sieged city of Limerick. The erudite barman, understanding the critical implications of such a request, promptly placed the out-of-favour Pound behind a snapshot of local poet Gerard Ryan. And there he remained, while the eminent Don sat recalling the times when his father drank whiskey from the same barrel and heated his rump by the same fireside. When the hour came round to leave, Mr. Graves autographed a photograph of himself for Mr. Gleason. Today it hangs beside Mr. Pound, and still not a word between them. And still not a word between them. Now, where exactly is that photograph in this pub? I haven't a clue. I'm looking at a Christmas decoration I'm lifting. It is possible that the photograph above it is Ezra Pound, but to be truthful, I wouldn't recognize. Ezra Pound, for those of you who know nothing about Ezra Pound, is the guy who cut out 52% of the wasteland. Yeah, 52% of the wasteland was removed by Ezra Pound. Now, I'm looking here, AJ and Melissa and Jesse, I'm looking at a photograph here of the President of Ireland, watched by Jan O'Sullivan, who was the Minister for Trade and Development, when he was a presidential candidate in 2011. Michael D. Higgins accepted a copy of Poems in Profile from the poet Brian Blaney, a.k.a. B.J. Slattery, in the White House bar on the 24th of September 2011. I'm looking at Brendan Behan. I'm looking at all sorts of people here. I'm looking at centenary quotes of Oscar Wilde. This place is quite a remarkable. I'm crossing the bar here to the side here because I can't take you on the full tour, but I'm taking you across to a man who meant an awful lot to me in my life called Jim Kemmy from Limerick. Jim Kemmy is here talking to Spring. Dan Spring? No, not Dan Spring. This is Spring. Oh, God. You don't remember? What was his name? Spring. Here. We have Jim Kemmy talking to... Dick Spring. Sorry, I might draw a blank for a minute. Dick Spring, of course. He was Taoiseach, wasn't he? Second in command in the Irish government. Head of the Irish Labour Party and very important in coalition governments in Ireland in the past. Anyway, these people, there are lots of people in this pub. And actually, I'm going to just introduce you for one second. I hope this man will humour me. He doesn't have to. But I've run into an extraordinary man, AJ Lay, and I'm in this pub here. And a man walked into the pub with a bag from Easons, and it contained a book he took out, and he put it on the table in front of him, and it's called The Silver Spoon. And I can tell you that if I try to lift it with my left hand, I really have to stretch to be able to hold it up. It's that thick. I don't quite remember how many pages are in it, but it's the Bible of Italian cuisine, published by Phaidon. And I've met this wonderful man from Holland who's... Now, I have to check with him if it's okay for him to record his voice. Can I record your voice?
Okay, no problem.
Can you tell me a tiny bit of your story? You're talking to some people who are in the United States of America who are wonderful,
right.
Who I last met, saw face to face for the very first time in my life in this pub. So I've come back to this pub to make a recording in historic celebration of that face to face meeting that we had in here.
It is a meeting place indeed here. So, yes, well, we just met, of course.
Yeah.
And we started out talking about cuisine, and now we're moving on to some other topics. So that's the way things work in an Irish pub, I suppose. This being said, it's the way it works here in the White House anyway.
And is this your first time in the White House, or did you meet here before?
No, the first time I came here was in December 1999, because I came here for my brother's stag night.
In the White House?
In the White House. This is where we started. It's not where we ended, it's where we started. So it was a very memorable evening.
Why did your brother pick here to be the starting point for his stag night?
Well, because he married a Limerick girl. Whom he met at Cork University, because he did a postdoc at Cork University, and his now wife was then studying there, and that's how they got together, and so they had to decide where to get married, so they got married in Limerick. Well, they got married just south in Adair.
In Adair.
Yeah.
Yeah, wonderful church in Adair.
Yeah, brilliant.
Wow,
yes.
What an ancient church.
It's an ancient church, and we had a brilliant celebration in Adair Manor, not in the Adair Manor, in
Adair is one of the most pretty villages of Ireland.
Nice village,
I think
yes.
It's actually won the competition for the prettiest village in Ireland many
that
times.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
That wouldn't surprise
got
me.
Got loads of thatched cottages on
yes.
the main street.
Exactly.
But look, let's talk about this book, The Silver Spoon, right?
Right.
You know about it more than I do, and today is my first experience of it. But it's the Italian equivalent of...
It's huge in the sense that...
How many pages? Hang on.
If we look at it, it's...
1,500.
Yeah, 1,500 pages.
1,503, I'm looking, and we're
yes.
right about a few pages
with
from the end.
With, of course, lots of photographs. So let's
yeah.
say over 1,000 pages with 2,000 recipes. It's it was first published in the 1950s, or 1950, actually,
yeah.
By an architectural and design magazine publisher.
Tell me about your love of food. Come on, never mind the book for a second.
A
tell me,
affair.
When did you start? Come on, when did you start cooking?
I started, I think it was at the age of 7. My first recipe was a French onion soup the way it was served in Les Halles. You know, that was then the food market in Paris.
In Paris,
France, yes,
right.
Which is now taken over by Rungis, which is just south of Paris. But in those days, it was still dead in the center of Paris. And like at 3-4 o'clock in the morning, the butchers, etc., they would come out and they'd be hungry after a day's work, so a night's work. And so that's where the onion soup became like a very much coveted.
So it was an artisan, a real basic kind of onion
yeah,
soup.
It's not
yeah?
a peasant dish, it's an artisan dish.
Yeah.
And it was basically at the end of the night. And actually in France, the French do not eat onion soup during the meal. Onion soup is something that is eaten after a party.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I never knew that.
It's a traditional way to end a wedding, for example. Yes.
You mean after the sweets, after the cake, later in the evening?
After the drinks.
Aha.
Once you need like a little bit more of the liquid and the salt, etc., to get the body going again, that's when you eat it. The French never serve you onion soup. It's for tourists.
Oh, I see. No, they will serve you. I won't be serving French onion soup at my dinner parties in future.
That's one of those things. But I did it. That was my first recipe. And after that, it kind of snowballed because my whole family loves to cook. And we have great discussions, cooking fests and stuff like that. So only last
Do you have cooking competitions within the family?
Kind of. Not officially, but in the end, it's what it sometimes boils down to. We had one last week. We had a family gathering, and then we have that every year, and we rotate. Like, you're in charge of starters this year, your main course this year, your side dish this year, your dessert this year, etc., etc. So it kind of rotates like that. And
I have a sister who lives in the United States, and she goes to San Diego with the family once a year, every year. Mm-hmm. And once a year, every year, the whole family gathers there, and you know, one person has responsibility for Monday, another has Tuesday, another has Wednesday and Thursday, and they vote.
Okay.
They vote on their...
That kind of like, guess who's coming to dinner or something like that. or the perfect dinner or whatever it's called.
But you're Dutch and you're living in Paris and you're married to an Irish girl from Limerick.
Yes. That's the way life goes.
And you've got a poet's name.
Apparently, that's what you're
absolutely
told me, yes.
That was what the first thing time I met you, I said, right, your first name is Theo. Mm-hmm. And Theo Dorgan is a very well-known modern Irish still living, poet. I mean, a wonderful poet.
All right.
And we're here. And Theo Dorgan,
Well, this is... and it's like you said, this is the poet's pub in a certain sense. Because they actually have the White House Poets Theater there in the corner.
But you do management work, you told me, in a sort of throwaway
training.
Phrase. Well, tell me what
training
you do. Tell me what you do. Just, give me an idea. What do you do?
I basically help help teams and managers to get more alignment within their realm of business, within their activity, and that's something that I do within the framework of making people feel better about what they are doing, giving meaning and that kind of stuff. So I help them become aware of where their added value is and how they should exploit that and what that means in the sense of decision making and all that kind of stuff.
You do it in Paris?
All over the world.
All over the world?
Well, basically, I work in Paris. I'm based in Paris.
Yeah.
And I work with French companies, but I also work with international companies, and for them, I travel a little bit all over the world.
So you do it in English?
English, French, German, and Dutch, depending on.
Right. Right.
So it's well, that's the advantage of being born in the southeast of the Netherlands. I kind of already grew up with two languages as mother tongue, basically, between Dutch and German. English, because you're in the Netherlands, that comes as a second, third language, quite easily. And after almost 25 years in France.
And what kind of people do you work with? What other kind of people do you work with? Do you work with some nice people, or do you do it all by yourself?
People can always be nice. It depends on how you approach them. I found in my life that there are very few nasty people, and even people who have like a nasty reputation, once you find the inroad to their let's say comfort zone, it kind of works out okay. So
and who are your heroes in the world of kind of business, like, for example, who would you have to dinner, you know, if you could have them living or dead? Now you're in terms of business world, who would you have to dinner?
Well, I actually would like...
So, you said something about the French? You said that the French are not very...
French management is based on analysis of documents, basically. It's very very much rational decision-making and working with reports and dossiers and all of that. But people management is not their strong point. And people management, they will often very often develop just their own personal style, which is kind of like unilateral. And one of the dimensions, or two of the dimensions, maybe three of the dimensions, will kind of fall by the wayside, you know? So you have to kind
of... Are they into command and control in France?
Oh, very much so, yeah.
Right.
Very much so.
I had a lovely experience.
Delegating is a real pain for me.
Oh, really? I had a funny, a very lovely experience in Dublin in October, where there was a thing called the Web Summit Dublin.
Right.
And I met a load of French entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And I met a number of CEOs there who were talking to me about branding. Uh-huh. And it looks to me as if that the French entrepreneurs look to the Anglo-Saxon world in terms of branding.
right? Absolutely, yes.
There doesn't seem to be an indigenous French branding culture.
Except for certain realms, no. You're right. Branding is something that's been done by the least inadequate person, let me put it that way. But it's not, branding is not a strategy, because branding means going out there. Branding means putting yourself or putting your product or your service or whatever it is, like I say, on the forefront. It's advertising, it's being visible, and the French don't like visibility.
But I was with, I went to visit what is one of the great champagne houses one of the great brandy houses, one of the great cognac houses in Cognac, one of the great ones. Yeah, I went to, no, it wasn't actually, anyway, Remy Martin, and you take Louis Vuitton, yeah, are also connected with one of the, you know, so you've, yeah, got a conglomerate of French brands, Hennessy,
LVMH.
And that whole massive branding kind of group, if, yeah, you like. Mm-hmm. Tremendous coherence about the way they project themselves,
absolutely,
you know,
yes,
and deeply embedded in French values of, in the case of brandy, it was the values of terroir and, you know, the kind of, well, the soil and the skills that were all used to create the essence of the experience from the consumer's point of view. And I was highly impressed by this. And I'm also still perplexed about the...
They kind of, it's always a little bit along the same lines. It's about tradition, good quality, terroir, the values are like the, let's say, ancestral values. But it's very few go, like Philip Starr goes for innovation. But he'd be like one of the few French people doing that.
Right, right. So
when,
innovation,
when you go into French branding,
yeah,
it's also about the classical French values. It's not about being innovative. It's not about being on the cutting edge. It's not about doing something new. It's about doing the old way, to the traditional way, and doing that well. And whether it's Louis Vuitton, whether it's Hennessy, whether it's Moët & Chandon champagne,
or Coco Chanel, or anything like this, they do put a huge emphasis on, yeah, the traditional artisans stuff.
We're new because
being able
doing
to cut well
with a twist.
Yeah, but so, we're in the last 30 seconds. I do a lot of podcasting. That's why you asked me, why am I doing this? I do a lot of podcasting. I do use a lot of audio. I use it in my work. I do it for my play, for my own satisfaction, not just for work. But I am... So I literally did want to record a piece of audio, especially for the people who I had such a great experience with here. And I've added to it now the wonderful thing of meeting you.
Okay. So thank you very much.
You are very, very welcome.
It's a wonderful experience.